Welcome from me, John Strickland, to Our Future Skies in partnership with AIG. In this podcast series, I'm talking with leaders across the airline industry, tapping into a diversity of views on where it might be headed in the next 10 to 20 years. While happily, the industry is making a very strong recovery from the COVID pandemic, by its very nature, it always faces many challenges. Sadly, that includes right now a number of geopolitical and military conflicts, not to mention significant global economic turbulence. Another reality is that the role of aviation and the level of activity varies significantly according to which part of the world we're looking at. And with that in mind, in this episode, we're going to discuss the future of the industry viewed through an African lens. Despite the continent's vast dimensions, challenging distances and surface infrastructure, a 1.4 billion population with the potential of an energized youthful profile, it lags the world in terms of commercial aviation. It can actually be quicker and easier to fly between two African countries by connecting in Europe or the Gulf than by traveling directly, if that is even possible. Now, one airline that has stood above the crowd and still does in Africa and has proved amply able to perform on the global stage is Ethiopian. My guest today is a man who led that airline to success, former CEO Tewolde Gebremariam, who today resides in the USA and is senior strategic advisor to Delta Airlines. So welcome, Tewolde. I'm really delighted to have you as my guest on Our Future Skies today and to speak to you after quite some time.
Thank you for having me in your podcast, and I'm happy to chat with you.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to it, Tewolde. Let's start. I mentioned already about Ethiopian Airlines, which, of course, you left early last year. So just tell us a little bit about how it was that you were able to bring such a level of success to that airline in your time there, while other airlines in Africa have not been able to do so.
Yes, you are right, John. When I reflect back now, it appeared to me like it was a miracle because, as you said, you know, I have been there leading the airline for 11 years. So the second decade of the 21st century, a little more. And the aviation industry in Africa has gone through really challenging time and crisis. Talking about between 2011, I started January 2011 to March 2022. So this was a period where we introduced two state-of-the-art modern 21st century aviation technology airplanes like the 787 Dreamliner early 2012. And, you know, the Dreamliner has had a lot of technical glitches here and there. And then we also introduced the most modern airplane, A350, from the Airbus family in 2016. Then we had Ebola in the continent, which was very dramatic at that time. And then oil price was, you know, this was a period at one time oil price has reached about $150 a barrel. And then the big challenge, the global pandemic, coronavirus, which was devastating the entire global aviation industry. So it was a period of, it was a testing period, I mean, for the some part for the entire aviation industry, and some crises were, some challenges were peculiar to the African aviation industry. But in the midst of all those crises and paradox was the 20 to 25% growth per annum, profitable growth that we recorded in Ethiopian Airlines. And you know, at the end of the day, when you see, I took over when the airline had only 32 airplanes. And when I left, we had 140 airplanes. Revenue was about $1 billion by the end of the fiscal year 2010. And I left with $5 billion. But the most surprising one is out of $5 billion revenue in 2022 when I left, $1 billion net profit. So it's about 20%. And during the corona, I mean the pandemic period, so many, many good things and very good strategic planning, and also meticulous, I mean ruthless execution, especially very, very focused on cost management, frugality, and so on. So I would say in terms of the strategy, we focused on the line you draw between China, India, Africa, and South America. So early on, we knew that Europe and America was were important markets for Ethiopian, but they were matured markets. So if we had to grow the places that we should grow, and the potential for growth was in China, India, Africa itself, and also South America. So we've connected these places, and at one time we were, I don't know now the current situation, but between Africa and China, we were market leader. We had 60% of the traffic between China and Africa. And as you know, this is a period also where China and the Chinese government focused investment in Africa. So we took advantage of that. And as you know, John, we are also very senior airline in China. We've been flying since 1973, when Chairman Mao was in leadership.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and you know, when China was not as open as it is today. Mm-hmm. So I would say it was an amazing period. And just to mention only the COVID, you know, when COVID has reached that stage where almost all airlines have grounded their airplanes, we went for a couple of months, and it was very controversial at that time to continue to fly to China when most airlines have suspended. But I had decided to carry on, to continue. But by March 2020, we found almost 95% of our passenger airplanes parked in the tarmac. So you can say almost no passenger business. And then we had to make a very tough decision because, you remember, John, most airlines had to depend on government bailout.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe and America, almost all. But that was not a possibility for us. That was not an option for us, unfortunately. So the only way to survive for us was to find a business somehow which can sustain us. And that was cargo. You know, as I said in the beginning, when I reflect back now, in 2011 and 2012, when I decided to buy the 777 freighters, 10 777 freighters and 737 freighters, dedicated freighters, people were laughing. And most people, including people in the board, this was too risky.
Right.
Yeah, but at the same time, I also decided to build the terminal. John, I don't know if you have seen it. It is the cargo terminal is one of the largest in the world. You can compare it with Changi or Hong Kong or Schiphol. So it's huge, 1 million tons cargo capacity a year. So these investments at that time were seen crazy and too risky, not wise. But 7-8 years forward, when the pandemic came, and they became breadwinners and the only survival kits. So we had to depend on cargo, and cargo was also booming at that time because every airline has stopped and the belly cargo capacity has gone out of the market. So there was capacity shortage. And on the other hand, demand was booming because, you know, mask, when we see mask today, it's a very small piece of clothes. But at that time, it was a lifesaver. So we had to transport masks, PPP in general, you know, gloves and medical supplies from China to Europe, to United States, to South America, to Africa. So it was a very good business. And parallel to it, we had to also made a very quick decision to remove seats from passenger airplanes, wide-body passenger airplanes, the 787, the 777. So I remember 25 wide body airplanes. We removed the seats in about 48 hours. So we had put them into the cargo business. So we saved the airline. And not only we saved the airline, but
made a profit.
Yeah, we made record profits, not only profit, record profit in the history of the airline. So 2020 was record profit. 21 was its own, broke its own record profit. Again, 22 was record profit. So it's a classic success in the aviation industry, John.
It's an amazing story, really an amazing story to Walt. So congratulations on that achievement, which is still continuing as we speak. Yeah. Now, given all those external challenges you faced and the success you delivered, let's move on to look a little bit more widely at the market and the whole dynamics as we go into the our crystal ball gazing about the future for Africa. I mean, I mentioned in my opening comments about some of the dynamics of the continent, the population. There's a growing middle class. You know, there's wide usage of mobile phones, including for banking. There's educational opportunities, something I want to dwell on a bit as we go along, an amazing young and entrepreneurial population. This sets a great context, surely, for this continent to really come out of the shadows that it's been in relative to other parts of the world.
Yes, you are absolutely right. But unfortunately, and you and I know that the aviation industry in Africa has not grown as much as all the conditions that you listed now. I mean, mm-hmm. A very large continent, young workforce of close to 1.4 billion population, and very rich in natural resources. A continent which contains more than 60% of global arable land for agriculture. So this should set, you know, a very robust and fast-growing economies. And as a result of that aviation, the aviation industry should have grown faster than we saw. But, you know, all said and done, at the end of the day, African aviation is only 2% of the global aviation business. So going forward, you are right. Now, many people say, and we have always been saying, that Africa is the next frontier in terms of aviation industry grows. And that has been the case for many years now. But the prevailing conditions on the ground are not enabling and have not been enabling. And I don't see much of hope even going forward. Having said this, I would also recognize progress has been made. Not enough progress, but some progress have been made, especially mm-hmm. in a little bit opening up of the market. And some, I would say, African governments have realized the value of aviation.
Let's explore that a bit, because, you know, I think for people who are less familiar with Africa, we see a lot of national carriers, mainly state-run, and airlines undoubtedly need a good relationship with their governments. But, you know, question number one, where is the line drawn between government's relationships and political interference? Because I think we see a lot in Africa of certain political impressions of aviation, viewing it as something for the elite, something of a privilege, and not really something that facilitates ordinary citizens or indeed acts as a catalyst for economic development.
Yeah, first, let's see the attitude of African governments towards aviation. I have spoken to many governments, to many head of states in the continent, many, many of them. I had the privilege of discussing in private with many heads of states, but when they put aviation in their priority list, it's almost in the bottom, because unfortunately they feel and they believe that aviation is luxury or it's for the rich people. That being the attitude or the perception on behalf of the government, when you go and see what's happening on the ground, it's completely different, because Africa is not like Europe with very extensive rail and fast train network. No. Roads are not as developed as Europe and America. No, again. So how else are people going to move from place to place? That's the only way is aviation. So it's not the rich man's means of transport. It is a critical public transport for the average person, for anyone, because there is no alternative. So that this has been our argument when we discuss with the government. Some of them believe, yes, you are right, but we have priority. Agriculture is priority, education is priority, healthcare is priority, so aviation comes in the bottom. Okay. On the other hand, then if that is the case, why do they own airlines? Why do they want to own airlines? And they do. Another paradox. They own airlines for a couple of reasons. Every nation in Africa, big or small, wants to put the flag on the tail of an airplane. It is a matter of prestige. It's a matter of image. Sometimes it's also a political tool during campaign and election. So what drives an airline to appear or to emerge or a startup airline on behalf of the government is, these are the reasons why. So, and none of them are economic. Of course, the need of connectivity is also there. But beyond the need of connectivity, as I said, it's a matter of image, it's a matter of prestige, and it's a matter of also, like, you know, country so and so has started an airline with this airplane and that airplane. So that sets a condition where professionals are not going to run the airline. Political appointees are going to run the airline. And then you start all the problems, political interference. And unfortunately, you know, the airline business is a very tough airline business, mm-hmm. John, as you know. Margins are rather thin. And if you make a small mistake, it is fatal because already in good time, the margins are very, very thin. You're talking about, you know, even IATA margin in good time is between 3 to 5%, right? Average.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this is very, very low. It's a very low ROI industry. So one has to be very, very careful in whatever they do to make sure to succeed. So the only exception is, again, Ethiopian Airlines, because it's 100% government owned, but very successful throughout its history and growing. Now, you know, it is competing with the mega carriers of the world, because look at our route structure. We are all the way from Japan, Korea, China, Southeast Asia, all Middle East, Africa, Europe, North America, and down to Argentina. So we are a global carrier.
Everywhere, pretty well.
Yeah, everywhere. So let's ask why Ethiopian Airlines succeeded being a government-owned airline while the other government-owned airlines failed. One reason, mainly, I would give credit to the Ethiopian government, not only to the current Ethiopian government, but to the past successive governments, right, starting from the emperor. They all remained disciplined, and despite their 100% ownership, they allowed professionals to run the airline. So that unique corporate governance allowed Ethiopian Airlines to succeed. Of course, other factors also, other success factors included, but this is the main one. So while the other African governments always are tempted to interfere, to put political appointees there, and, you know, so it didn't work. For instance, a good example is South African Airways. It used to be very good airline, John. You know, it a very good product, high premium product, and very good mm-hmm. airline. But now it's history. I think they are trying to revive it. So if you ask me professionally, I would say ownership is a factor, but it's not a decisive factor in success, because you can be government-owned, but if the corporate governance is well-defined and identified, especially the relationship between the board and the management, it can work. It worked for Ethiopian Airlines because all you have to do is you have to separate ownership and management. The owners should not be managers. I think even in private setup, the owners are not managers. As you know, in the global airline business, owners are stock shareholders. I mean, anyone who has bought share in the airline. But managers are hired to manage the airline. So as long as ownership and management is clearly separated with clearly defined, distinct roles and responsibilities, it can work.
And we've seen more widely over quite a number of decades now toward the efforts to make progress within Africa. People of the industry know about something called the Yamoussoukro decision, which was back in 1999 when all African countries, well, 44 countries, agreed they would liberalize African aviation to actually make progress. So that was ratified in 2002. It was still not there by 2018 when the single African air transport market, SATAM, was launched to fully implement this earlier Yamoussoukro decision. More countries joined. You know, there was efforts to make more progress, but we still haven't seen it. And we see other airlines eating the African pie, you could say. I mean, good for them, good for travelers. Airlines such as the Gulf carriers. But do you hold out hope that lessons can be learned from this lack of progress and countries can come together? Because Ethiopian gives a shiny example of what could be done in many more places. South African Airlines, as you pointed, an airline historically globally renowned that's fallen largely by the wayside. Do you feel hopeful that we can point back in the right direction?
Yes, I'm hopeful. Well, I'm disappointed by YD, as many of us are. It has been a very long time and it has not delivered the intentions and expectations. Although, you know, there were some slow, gradual progresses. Like, for instance, apart from the fifth freedom within Africa, the third and fourth freedom, I mean, the bilateral negotiations have improved a little bit. So traditionally, very closed countries, very closed economies have shown some flexibility in negotiating better bilateral air service agreements for carriers. But in general, I would say I would agree with anyone that it was a disappointment. It was written, I mean, signed, sealed, and agreed by all, but it has never been implemented. Out of this frustration, some of us approached in the African Union. I remember when the lady Secretary General from South Africa was in charge in Addis. I went to her and I had a meeting with her and I told her why it has not worked and African aviation is not progressing, especially for African airlines. Because when you see the continent is well connected with the rest of the world because of foreign carriers. Mm-hmm. But within the continent, connectivity is a major hindrance in economic activities. So I explained this to her and I told her that it's African airlines only have 20% of the market share. 80% of the market share is enjoyed by non-African airlines. So we need to change this. So she agreed. And so she asked me, what is the solution? Okay. The solution is either we have to come up with a new mechanism, a new system to liberalize African aviation, or we have to change widely. And then she asked me, okay, when she talked to government, they always point out to their airlines because their national carriers are the most protective ones. So she said, okay, can you get me four major airlines CEOs here? I want to talk to them and I want to get their opinion. So I said, okay. So I called Kenya Airways, Egypt Air, TAG Angola, SAA, South African Airways, and of course, ET myself. So we met her in her office in Addis, and all of us told her, except TAG, I remember, that we have to liberalize. That was the only exception. So she was very happy, and she gave her instruction to her Commission of Infrastructure and Transport. And then that's how SATM was started, the Single African Air Transport Market. And we're very happy. I think we are in the number of, I don't know, it must have reached now 40 countries ratifying it. So going through that process, we mentioned that one of the reasons why the YD failed and didn't deliver was because there were some missing instruments. Number one, there was no competition rules. Number two, there was no consumer protection rules. Number three, there was no dispute resolution mechanism. So we went back to AFCAC, the African Civil Aviation Commission, and we asked them to develop these instruments. And now both of the, all three of them are ready. So SATM, we have better hope and better wish for the future on SATM, because those instruments are now in place. Because if you don't have competition rules, you know, some airlines will be negatively affected. So there must be competition rules, the rule of the game for airlines. And also, if you don't have consumer protection regulation, then the consumer ends up paying the price by some monopoly or some unfair competition. And then the dispute resolution, when if two airlines or countries do not agree on going forward, then there must be a dispute resolution mechanism and regulation in place. So now these are in place. I'm very hopeful that the SATM will be implemented in a better speed and better implementation than YD. The other hopeful situation is the free trade area, the ACFTA, the African Continent Free Trade Area. That is also now ratified by almost all countries. So free movement of people, free movement of goods, that is also now is going to be boosting SATM. So yeah, I'm very hopeful, but still progress is very slow, John.
Understandably. And I was thinking, as you outlined that background of challenges, but also the progress you made when you had that meeting with the secretary in Addis, that really the politicians, the leaders of Africa, owe this to this young generation. I've spoken recently to a couple of young Africans that I know, and I said to a couple of them, is it fair to say that many young Africans simply have to leave their own countries to find opportunities? And one of them replied to me, that's more than fair. And said to me, tell Tawadi, you know one of them who's had to leave their country to find an opportunity. We also see that there could be so much more wide economic benefit for the continent if we could make these steps forward. But we still have a situation that even without the political challenges, as you said, this kind of vanity project approach of some countries to have their airline, that many airlines are loaded with heavy taxes right from the start. So with a high tax burden, not only on fuel, but other taxes, including ticket taxes, it must provide an enormous handicap to airlines in Africa to make progress.
Yes, you are right, because that taxation or heavy taxation is the result of the attitude of the government towards aviation, because they consider aviation as a luxury, as a rich man's means of transport. Then they equate it with alcoholic drinks, alcoholic beverages, and even tobacco. You know, the taxation on tobacco and alcoholic beverages is almost equal to air transport. So it's insane. I mean, it's crazy why that is happening. Again, the attitude has not changed, but the attitude is also in the entire leadership and governance and democratic dispensation in the continent. But we have to also realize that Africa is a big continent of 54 countries. So there are countries which have made progress. I think there are about 17 or 18 countries which have a growing democracy, which have, you know, Senegal, Ghana, even Nigeria, in terms of democratic progress, elections, and so on. They're doing well. Kenya, Tanzania, Malawi, Zambia, South Africa, Botswana, and so on. So there are differences among the countries. But when it comes to the aviation industry, I still believe that there is no right attitude, because aviation is the engine of economic development, especially, as you said, for the young entrepreneurs, for the young, smart and intelligent people, and enlightened by the information technology now, by the internet, by the augmented reality, AI, and so on. So they want to do a lot of things, and they can. But unfortunately, they don't have enabling environment in their countries. And you are right, they live to Europe and America. So the brain drain is really a serious problem, including in the aviation business. When we started to grow in Ethiopian Airlines, and when we started with 20-25% growth per annum, our main challenge was pilots. So although traditionally we heavily depended on Ethiopian pilots, so we had to start hiring from the global market. At the moment, I mean, about 15% of our pilots, of Ethiopian Airlines pilots, are foreigners from the global market. So the brain drain is also a major problem. And as we said, that is caused by the lack of hope, lack of enabling environment in the continent.
Well, I was going to ask you, because I've asked other leaders in this series, you know, AI has become a watchword. Digitalization is happening everywhere, and the pace of change is incredibly quick. You've already answered it in part, but is that more broadly positive in the context of African aviation, or is it challenging precisely because you need to have a good pipeline of young talent to lead the industry? But is that being fostered enough, and how does it sit with technology? People worry about technology actually replacing people. Does it work with or against?
On a positive side, John, I think it's a good opportunity for Africa, because it will enable it to leapfrog quickly to the level of the continent. Doesn't have to crawl, I mean, doesn't have to go slow to reach the level of technological advancement in the developed world. So the new IT technology will give it the opportunity to leapfrog. Like, for instance, look at mobile money. Mobile money, Kenya is one of the leaders in the world. So mobile money, it enabled Kenya to bypass even the developed world, because you and I in the developed world are still using credit cards. But exactly. Kenya was able to pass that. So they don't worry about credit card anymore. Everyone is transacting with their mobile. M-Pesa, you know, it's a global success story. So this kind of success will come, this kind of leapfrogging, jumping over will come in terms of technological advancement. So it's an opportunity for the continent. But on the challenge side, John, AI, especially particularly AI, I have my own reservation, meaning we have to be careful in using AI. Otherwise, if AI is somehow overpowering human beings, then we will have a serious repercussion. So I don't believe AI should overpower people. It should be under the control of people. And also, like, for instance, you know, the airline business is a service business. So the human element is always needed. You know, the human touch is always needed and appreciated by the customers. So you cannot completely replace all service elements and service areas by AI.
Well, I had a recent experience of a flight cancellation at an airport, and there were elements of technology which helped me to get another flight, but I actually wanted people around me to reassure me and tell me help me through that situation.
Yeah, you are a human being, so you are nervous at that time because a flight is canceled. So you want to be assured by someone, a human being like you. Hey, John, you are okay. This is what we are going to do. And this is how we are going to reroute you on this flight, this and that. That's assurance. AI can do it. And as you said, it did it, but you were not sure whether things will be smooth or not.
Towardi, let's just look a little bit briefly at infrastructure and a little bit more widely at aircraft. I mean, you mentioned the lack of infrastructure when it comes to roads, but just thinking as well in terms of airports, air traffic control, all the infrastructure that airlines need to operate and to do so safely. And Africa, or let's be more precise, parts of Africa have suffered historically in terms of safety. Many parts of the continent are at the highest level of safety. But who is going to make that investment in infrastructure? And again, are we going to face government problems where people want to build palaces rather than efficient pieces of infrastructure that actually serve the airlines and consequently serve the customers?
You are right, John. The infrastructure, the aviation infrastructure in Africa is way underdeveloped as compared to the rest of the world. And I don't see also way out in the near future because private investment in aviation infrastructure is not growing or is not, we don't see that many activities in that area. So we still have to depend on governments to build airports and or to modernize air traffic control system or ground services at the airport. But as it is today, much to be desired. Let's just make a comparison. A small country in Europe, Switzerland, with 9 million population, around 9 million population, has two international airports, Geneva and Zurich. A much larger population country, Uganda, close to 48 million population, has only one small airport in Entebbe. So we have a long way to go. But again, it's a matter of priority. I would say instead of building 1,000 kilometer of road to connect between countries in Africa, it is much cheaper and much more effective to build 3 kilometers of runway, which is an airport. But it has to be viewed that way. It is cheaper, it's more efficient to build airports and runways than even train. And it's going forward, it's also, it will be more sustainable in terms of sustainability because you waste a lot of carbon, a lot of energy to build roads and railroads, although trains are now, electric trains are sustainable and less carbon emission. But to build an airport as compared to this infrastructure is much cheaper, much more sustainable and more efficient. So I think we need a paradigm shift especially in the way governments look at aviation and it's also, I take it upon us, upon the airlines, the professionals to, you know, lobby, to educate governments, to give them the facts again and again. So we have to continue.
Absolutely. And back on the aircraft side, toward you mentioned what you reflected on Ethiopian, you talked about bringing in the 787, the Airbus A350. I think we're in an exciting era, aren't we, in terms of new aircraft availability that are really very appropriate to African development, not only aircraft like those two, which are relatively large and perform ultra long haul missions, but now we have narrow body ultra long range aircraft like the new Airbus A321, LR, XLR. And at a regional level, we're seeing probably an increase in average size of regional aircraft and longer range aircraft like the, again, Airbus A220 or the Embraer E2 series. Do you think yourself that is a valid observation? These are better aircraft in terms of what Africa needs for the future?
Yes, especially as I said, let's look at the continent's aviation industry. As I said before, the intercontinental coverage is almost okay, acceptable. I mean, Africa is well connected with Europe, with United States, with Asia, and so on. And now, you know, the new trend, the new emerging trend is direct connection between the United States and Africa, especially West Africa. And just for your information, Delta is the largest carrier flying to five African destinations direct from the United States. So that the intercontinental is okay, acceptable, well covered, well connected. The real problem is within the continent. So within the continent, the narrow body, the new narrow body and the new regional airplanes, more efficient airplanes are required for the continent. Let me share my vision. You know, the center of Africa is Central African Republic, a country which has been suffering with civil war and very bad challenges. So Bangui, Central African Republic, is the center. So in Bangui, if you establish an airline in Bangui or around that area, even in Cameroon, you can connect Algiers with 737, the farthest northern point of the continent, and Cape Town, the farthest south point, and then Dakar, the farthest west, and Djibouti, the farthest east. And all of these are covered either by the A320neo or the 737 MAX, including the A320, the Airbus, the former Bombardier C-Series airplane, now A220 and A320. So there is a huge opportunity and potential for a startup airline to use this fuel-efficient, modern, narrow-body airplanes. And at the same time, they also contribute to sustainability because these airplanes save 15 to 20% fuel and carbon emissions. So, yeah. But unfortunately, John, as we speak today, production is lagging behind.
That's a challenge, isn't it? Getting places on the production line.
Yeah, production line is lagging behind demand. So every airline wants an airplane. There is huge demand, but the manufacturers are not able to meet the demand. And that is caused by the backlog in during the COVID. And also, you know, the supply chain system or the ecosystem of the aircraft manufacturing programs involve a lot of small suppliers. So during COVID, all of them have closed and laid off their employees. So it was starting from ground zero after COVID, and the demand unexpectedly grew very, very fast than usually expected. So yes, supply chain is a very, very strong challenge right now. Both on airframe and engines.
Absolutely. Just switching on to a couple of different areas toward the sustainability, which, you know, has been talked about all the time now in the airline world. And obviously, I'm sitting here in Europe, and we're seeing situations of airport capacity being cut back and curfews brought in and politicians wanting to have less low fares available. I just wonder, particularly talking to you, as I said, with this African perspective on aviation, if we're looking at an incredible shift in the world. You're living in the USA, but you are an African, and I think we see concern about sustainability and maybe changes in the US aviation market. Do you think we might be reaching a kind of a dichotomy between, say, the US and Europe and the rest of the world where, let's be really extreme, Europe could shut down aviation completely because of worries about the environment, while the rest of the world is using it as an economic tool and continuing. We're seeing massive aircraft orders coming in from places like Saudi Arabia, India, China. We should be seeing more developed in Africa. How do you see that playing out? Because it's a challenge. We have to address it from a point of view of the industry's contribution to the problem, but we can't just say, well, we don't have aviation anymore.
Yes, I think Europe is also going too far. I mean, in imposing some of the restrictions that we saw. So I don't think that is the right way to go, because we have to address the environment issue. We have to address sustainability. It is the responsibility and duty of this generation, especially we owe to the next generation. And that is a right priority, a top priority in everyone's mind. But at the same time, production is also needed. So, you know, as I always say at in my previous job at Ethiopian Airlines, I have two eyes, so I follow double visioning, meaning one eye has to be squarely focused on today, and the other eye has to be squarely focused on tomorrow. So sustainability is for today and tomorrow, but we have to live also today. We have to exist. Production has to continue. So you cannot, I mean, shut off production today and completely focus for tomorrow. On, so the right balance is needed. On the other hand, those countries or those people who believe that, oh, production, we have to grow this and that, I think we have to sit together, discuss, and find the right formula, the right mix between production and sustainability. Otherwise, the way Europe is going also is not sustainable by itself, because, okay, you can shut off short-haul travel in Europe because the trains can substitute it, and they are doing so comfortable to travel by train from a point A to point B. In Europe, I've done it several times, and I always prefer, by the way, within Europe. But long haul has to continue. There is no other means of transport to replace that. So I would say balancing both. And when it comes to Africa, you know, we have to be realistic there, and we have to be fair also for the continent, John, because what's the contribution of carbon in Africa? I mean, it's very, very low as compared to the developed world. So you can say Africa is being affected for no fault of its own. I mean, for not much contribution. So we should not expect Africa to be at the level of the industrialized world in terms of sustainability. But we have to address that. So what I mean is Africa needs support from the developed world, because it cannot do it on its own. It needs financial support. It needs technological support. Because if airlines in Africa want to buy new airplanes because their contribution to sustainability is good, 15 to 20% carbon reduction, where else are they going to get the money, the capital, access to capital? So this kind of issues need to be addressed collectively. So I think environment issues are collective. Every human being in the planet is concerned and is responsible. So it cannot be done in isolation. Europe cannot do meaningful sustainability on its own. It needs China, it needs US, it needs Africa, Asia, and so on. So it's a collective responsibility.
Oh, absolutely. As you said, the old world, so to speak, of US and Europe, many African countries could point their finger and say, well, you caused the problem over centuries.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we're trying to catch up in economic life of our citizens. We can't take on all the problems you created ourselves and just be told to hold back.
Yeah.
Let's just move on a bit more widely to probably one of the closing questions to Aldi, looking into your crystal ball again at a geopolitical level. We've talked about a lot of instability, a lot of shocks. Do you think we're going to see a world order that is continuing to change? Will we, for example, see more realignment of Africa with, for example, the BRIC countries? So this grouping, this economic grouping looking south and east is strengthening. It seems to me, as someone in the old world, it's inevitable. You know, if we look through centuries, we see ups and downs and different developments of countries and continents. Is that going to happen in an era where Africa becomes much more preeminent and the dynamics shift?
Yes, Africa will get more prominence, more importance, and the West will also focus now on Africa, because there seems to be alternative now for Africa. And in the last couple of decades, we've seen that the Chinese solution for Africa, especially in terms of infrastructure building, has worked, and it has been a very good solution for many African countries in terms of building roads, railroads, or ports, airports, bridges, and so on. Both the technology is cost effective, and also the way it is packaged by the Chinese government. I remember when I built the cargo terminal in Ethiopian Airlines and the airport, we usually send RFP to all globally, and the Chinese construction companies come with their turnkey type of project. Like, they come with the construction, with the design, and also financing, because the China Exim Bank is always available for them. So they already bring it to the customer packaged. On the other hand, the West is not organized in that manner. In fact, the banks are independent, private, so they can evaluate projects on their own, due diligence and so on. So they can say, no, this is not the right risk for us to take. So the construction companies lose the business to the Chinese. So that has been going on. But in terms of the BRICS, in terms of a complete shifting, I'm not that hopeful, and because the BRICS has been there, John, for many years now, right?
That's true.
Yeah, but what has achieved so far? Not much. Mm-hmm. Not much as expected, or not much as, because, you know, the center of economic growth and capital and consumer market is still in Europe and America. So the African countries, no matter how they view it, no matter how they want to change, the reality will always pull them to A, the capital market, to access capital, B, the consumer market, the market which has a disposable income. Europe and North America put together is a billion consumer market with high disposable income. So a billion population with high disposable income. So this will continue to remain as a center of gravity in terms of economic power. And therefore, the African countries will continue to depend. But I see a lot of efforts towards BRICS, towards China, and so on. I am not undermining the influence of China in Africa. And also, they have done a very good job in terms of infrastructure building, much needed critical infrastructure building. And the Belt and Road Initiative is also very good. But still, you know, the most powerful currency, the dollar, is still the medium of exchange, reserve currency, and so on. So reality is not pointing towards the efforts being done.
Well, Tawdry, that's probably a good point to draw our conversation for this time to a close. I certainly feel very inspired by what you've had to say. I've learned more about Africa. I see a lot of positive things there for the future, with Ethiopia being the model for what can be done. So, Tawdry Gabrymariam, Senior Strategic Advisor, many thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you for having me. And I enjoyed our chat, our discussion. Thank you.
Thanks to you for listening, and I hope we've provided some valuable insights into our future skies viewed through African eyes. I'll be back soon with our next Our Future Skies episode in partnership with AIG. But for now, from me, John Strickland, goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by our speakers are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no representations as to accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and will not be liable for any errors, omissions, or delays in this information, or any losses, injuries, or damages arising from its use.